All right.
And, you know, supposedly in the fall, we'll see, with Angelina, and so far no other actors. So we're kind of, you know, working it out right now, the script. But, hey, they told me I solved it, so...
Is she in, or is she is attached, or what's the thing with her?
It's, you know, it's very much kind of her project. She, right. You know, she's been she's a huge proponent of it, and she's a... one of the characters she's always wanted to play.
Is
so she's almost a driving force behind it, actually.
Is she a fan of Ayn Rand? Has she read her stuff?
Who, Angie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what I was saying. She's very much, you know, she's the one driving this whole thing.
Well, the reason I was thinking...
It's kind of strange, isn't it? You know, her, like... altruistic side, and you know all the charity that she does, and the, you know.
Well, who do you think Ayn Rand was politically in her heyday in the 30s and 40s? When I think of her, I think
she's a libertarian.
A libertarian, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She, you know, a lot of people mistakenly think that she was right wing, but she was actually, you know, what makes her different from right wingers is that she is not. She's very much anti-religion.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
And so, you know, she's her own thing, you know, and, you know, pretty radical even nowadays. It was the whole thing was really in direct response to the Soviet Union and to the regime there, and, you know, because she escaped in 1924 to America.
Yeah.
And that was my window into it, too, because I'm not a huge, you know, Randist by any means, but, you know, I definitely could see how, if there's something to be said for the objectivism and the philosophies, that, you know, hopefully Soviet unions won't happen. You know,
well, you know, I was going to say that I was starting to kind of wonder about Angie's political orientation when she recently, not that long ago, basically said that the surge has done good things as far as stabilizing and allowing for more humanity and more stability in terms of, you know, people having a chance to assemble and reassemble their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And she seemed to pretty much be saying, although for different reasons, she was kind of not that far from the John McCain position. And I was thinking to myself, okay, that's a new one. I didn't realize that that's where she was. I know what she's saying. She's saying she wants fewer people to be slaughtered and to have, you know, children have some semblance of stability in their lives, and that there be more of a wholesomeness, some shred of wholesomeness over there. But it's but it did strike me that she's sort of getting behind the conservative end of things.
Yeah. I don't, you know, tell you the truth, I don't know what her political stance is.
Yeah.
Don't really follow that, but she's definitely into, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, I am to a certain extent, but I just think anything that's very dogmatic like that is not for me. I'm not an extremist in any sort.
Yeah.
In any way.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, Vadim, did you happen to know the Russian exec producer, the guy who is missing now, who had pretty good taste as far as his projects were concerned? I think he was the one who.
The guy who was with Eric Eisner.
Yeah, and he it was the film that he I'm told entirely financed was Hamlet 2,
right,
which showed at Sundance.
Yeah, and actually, my old assistant Matthew was writing a Russian mob story for them.
Okay.
And I found out from Matthew first that he went missing. You know, because Matthew said they just suddenly stopped communicating with him. He was in the middle of a rewrite or something like that. And now he doesn't even know if he's going to get paid or what's going to happen.
Well, they found traces of blood at his DACA.
Well, they definitely whacked him. There's no question.
Yeah.
But, you know, still...
You were just saying, you know, the world, you know, the Russian temperament, you know, but I was just trying to imagine, what is that? That's because money was lent? Is that what's going on there?
Yeah, you know, I think technically it was, he had a big part in a cellular firm, you know, like an AT&T kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Over there.
Yeah.
And then what happened is some other group I guess, wanted him to sell, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't, or somehow, it's business, you know, it's completely... The thing is, in Russia, what's interesting, now it's getting a little bit better, but what's interesting is there was no contracts. There was no legal recourse to any sort of a grievance.
Right.
In business. You know, especially when the wall came down, just in the first, like, the early 90s. You know, you make a deal with somebody to deliver, say, potatoes, you know, and the guy doesn't show up.
Right.
You know, you can't like, go take him to civil courts. There's no such thing as tort, you know, courts.
Yeah.
So where your only recourse is to basically either scare him or kill him,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's just as a lesson to others. I mean, it's interesting, you know. It's like a Chicago in the 20s, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the corruption really breeds that, too. Yeah.
Right.
I'm so happy you like this film. I really am. You know, it's because this film needs champions, you know? I think,
Well, it's definitely a class act all the way, and that's something that you...
Thank you.
I think that half... sometimes I think that what people like about movies is it's almost half of it is how assured and enveloping it feels from a... almost a tactile, you know, or kind of a almost an erotic standpoint, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Very erotic, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's very sumptuous.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the other half is, of course, what it's saying, what it's about, what the theme is. But if it feels and moves in a beautiful way, or I shouldn't say beautiful, I mean, so many traumatic things.
Yeah, but it is beautiful. It's, I mean, everything, even that rotting fruit and the ants on that bird.
Yeah.
You know, all these things. I mean, I think they're beautiful because they have meaning. If they were just random images, I don't think, you know, I don't.
Right.
They have meaning. But that's the decay of her existence, and you know, and so on.
Yeah.
I'm really, you know, I'm very proud of it, and I'm very pleased. And I got disheartened because it was like a year of basically dicking around with it and going back and forth and back and forth with the studio. And I think ultimately we did great work, you know. But it was at the time it was like all these previews where people were like, "What? You know, hell was that?" They walk out, they're scratching their head. Why did I just waste my time?
Yeah.
You know, all that kind of stuff. And I went, "My God, did I really miss it that badly?" You know, and you know, to hear people like you, who I respect, Nick Dimianoff, and other critics, you know, say that to me, that's like it really is music to my ears because I don't, you know, me, I don't make movies. It's not a job for me.
Right.
Really, it's not a gig, you know. I don't like the word career, and I don't like, you know. I even bristle at the point, you know, when people used to ask me, "So how did you get DreamWorks to hire you to do House of Sand and Fog?" I always sounded like such an asshole. So I go, "The fuck are you guys talking about? How did I get DreamWorks to hire me? I bought the rights. I financed. I found the $9 million out of 15 in foreign.
Yeah,
and then basically I hired DreamWorks to distribute it. You know,
right."
Yeah, but I mean, you know, sounded very arrogant of me, of course, but but it's the truth, you know.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's, you know, it really, and I don't mind making a movie every 5 years because, you know, did you ever see My Architect?
Yes, that's the father-son thing, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
The son
yeah.
did it.
Yeah.
I think it's one of my favorite documentaries because it's brilliant. And it really, I remember sitting there with tears in my eyes when I.M. Pei is being interviewed.
Yeah.
And about Louis Kahn, and he says, you know, I have thousands of buildings. I've made thousands of buildings, built them, and I have millions and millions and millions and billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And he said, I would trade all that for 6 of Louis Kahn's buildings. You know, and to me, that's like, fuck it. I was sitting there, and I said, that's exactly what I want to do. You know, I don't want to leave a long IMDb page behind.
Yeah.
I want to leave, even like if it's 4 or 5 great films, I will have done what I wanted to do, you know.
Well, but I would say, if I were your agent, Vadim, I would say, well, Vadim, why don't you do, because you are very good in terms of just delivering a really great texture. You know, you deliver really good texture, good production design. It looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you, you know, every other film, just make one of their films and just do that job because you're really good at it, and then
even that,
do the
I don't believe doing one for them, one for you. I really don't, because I think, you know what I have, I'm blessed with it. I'm still doing commercials.
Yeah.
But that really allows me the financial freedom to just basically say, you know what, I don't need to take a job. I'm not coming into it from a point of view of fear.
But when guys like you do genre stuff, because you're not just...
Listen, I get offers nonstop. Actually, people do know that. I'm actually a really, really good action director. I mean, that's probably my biggest strength. If you look at my commercials, they're all very intense actions, car chases, you know, things like that. Very big, big scope. I mean, I can out Michael Bay, you know.
But it's more interesting when guys like you are kind of wedged into a genre thing, because you always bring extra elements to it, whereas a straight-ahead genre director like Michael Bay won't have as much undercurrent.
The last Batman, Chris Nolan, did such a great job. That's why, you know, even the Harry Potters, the last couple were done by good directors.
Yeah, exactly.
They bring a lot to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I just saw it. It was incredibly dumb and confusing film, but it was so well done. Was that Golden Compass?
Oh, you know, I
saw it on the plane. It looked really amazing, even on the plane. I was really struck by how well it was lit. And
it's funny how people make decisions about this. But I swear to God, when I first saw what this is going to be, and I heard the word golden, anything that has the word golden in it, gives me a problem right from the get go.
It's like an exclamation mark at the end of the title. First sign of death.
When do you think Atlas Shrugged might conceivably go? Would it be sometime in 2009? Would it be
we're planning for the fall. I mean, that's,
definitely this fall, no question about it.
Yeah, that's what Lionsgate is saying. You know, she's pregnant now, stops being pregnant, and you can get, you know, the script is in good shape. You know, I think, there's still a bit of work to be done on the script.
Well, when is she giving birth? Is it sometime in the late summer?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. And she's going to go right to work as soon as after 2 months or something?
That's what she's saying. That's what her manager's saying. He's also the producer on the project. But
she's a real battle axe. I really admire her for that.
Twins, right?
Yeah.
Caring.
I really.
She's a great woman. You know, she's the real deal as far as a person goes.
Right.
You know, there's so many of them that are, you know, don't live up to their PR at all, as far as brains or whatever, but Angie's the real deal. She's very smart. Mm. And very, you know, she knows what she wants. She's smart.
Now, you are the sole adapter screenplay. Am I understanding that right?
Well, I rewrote. There's been probably about 50 screenplays written, including one by Ayn Rand herself.
Well, what is the most recent one that you liked, that you revised?
I didn't like any of them.
What's the one that you half liked? You at least thought it was half
there. The one I'm rewriting technically is, what is his name? Randall Wallace.
Oh, Randall Wallace of Braveheart.
Yeah, Randy wrote the version that I basically took on.
Okay. So. When did he write that? Back in the 90s?
No, just recently.
Just recently? Okay.
Yeah. There's been many, many versions of it, but for this one he wrote just recently. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, it's funny, the more you read, one reads scripts, and I just don't know what to think about. I've fallen in, I mean, I'm sure this has happened to you. You've read scripts and you've said to yourself, you know, even a mediocre director can't screw this one up.
Yes.
And it's because it's so well done, you know?
Yeah, script is everything. There's no way, there's no director in the world that can make a bad script good. No director at all. Because it's, you know.
But I've seen scripts that I thought were really, I said, this has got to be good, and I've seen them degraded by directing them in the wrong way.
You can definitely spoil it, but you can't elevate a script.
Yeah.
You can elevate, you can just dress it up, but that's about it. You can, as I always said, what's interesting, you know, the flat, there's something flat, in order to make it look three-dimensional, you have to spin it really fast.
Yeah.
And that's exactly, so if you can fool the eye just by motion or color or whatever it is, you know.
Were you, how much different in would a person, I remember reading House of Sand and Fog before it came out and thinking, this has got to be really good, and then it was as good as I thought it was going to be. But
it was exactly, because it was exactly the script.
I didn't
change anything. Yeah. You know, it's my script. And actually, it's funny, there was no drafts whatsoever. It's just, I wrote it once. And it took me 14 days. Can you believe it?
Well, because I assume that there's one thing to have a vision of a film, but it's another thing that to be open to, you know, the fresh idea, the extra idea, the way of doing something differently, slightly. I just presume that's what part of the filmmaking process is. It's not strictly making real the words on the page. It's taking the words on the page and making it into something else. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, for me, I'm, as you said, you know, I'm very much into the visual aspect of it, and I'm very much into film language.
Yeah.
You know, to me, that's, you know, I can't really call myself a great student of film, but innately, you know, I want to speak through the camera,
right,
as well as the script. You know, for me, it's very, and this one was actually kind of weird because I didn't write the script.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So it's kind of strange for me to direct it, and I didn't like it that much. You know, I like directing my own script much more.
Yeah. By the way, you did something that really irritated me. It happens every time someone is driving in a movie. Uh-huh. I really don't like this. She is passing by the school, and they're putting the yellow banners up, and it's in commemoration of the tragedy. And she's driving, and she just keeps staring at the banners. And and every time I see that, I say, "Will you look at the fucking road, please?"
I mean, what people do. Yeah, I know.
Only actors do that because they're being dragged by a camera thing.
Yeah, that's my fault. You're right. You know, just sharing. Yeah, you know, how about those conversations that people have?
Yeah, when they talk to you, and the driver's looking at the person for reaction as they're driving, and I just want to kill them. You know.
I think, I don't know how long. I'm going to give myself a pass on that one. It's not that long. she's going slowly, and there's all other conceivable traffic on the road.
Hey, I'm not one to talk. You know, I mean, I am absolutely. I've literally told myself you're an idiot as I'm in traffic on Pico Boulevard, say, and there's a little bit of a lull, and I start looking at a text message. On the iPhone.
Exactly.
I mean, come on. I mean, I'm just, that's just looking for trouble, you know. And but a lot of people do that. I know that they do, so, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, the texting, the cell phones have become really, you know.
Yeah.
You know, quite a
scourge. Did, you know, you must have occurred to you, you know, you're one could say, you know, looking at the reviews and looking at the art and understanding the synopsis of Life Before Our Eyes, that you've basically made a kind of a, you know, chick flick, and
You know what? It certainly comes off that way from the promotional materials, definitely.
Yeah.
And it is all about women, but I don't think so. You know what's heartening to me is that now I'm starting to do all these Q&A screenings, and people are coming up, like guys are coming up to me after and saying, "Man, you know, I thought this was going to be a chick flick, but I'm so incredibly like those." It's not. You know, it's definitely, it's you know, it's about women, but it's not necessarily for women.
That's the feeling I had about Curtis Hanson's film. I don't like, for instance, the one that's that I just read about in the New York Times yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
It's called it's the Shopaholic thing that Jerry Bruckheimer is doing, and
Curtis Hanson's doing that?
No. The person who's directing it is P.J. Hogan.
Uh-huh.
But and I thought to myself, and Jerry Bruckheimer is quoting, "If we do our job right, this could be another Wedding Crash." I said,
I read that actually.
A movie about a shopaholic syndrome? I mean, are you kidding me? That's like, that's not a fundamental human current. That's just something. I can't imagine why they think that.
How's Bruckheimer going to blow something up in that movie? How's that going to happen?
I don't know. But it's, you know, it's going to be, you know, P.J. Hogan has a certain style to it. Anyway, I was about to say that I really loved In Her Shoes, the Curtis Hanson thing. And to me, that obviously is a woman's picture, but it taps into things that make you share immediately.
Yeah.
And
there are some directors that are very sensitive. You know, it's interesting. I guess you know, they have a very developed, and they're in touch with their feminine side. You know, it's interesting. You know, because many male directors have trouble making films about women.
Right.
For women.
Yeah.
You know? But you know, I felt that was actually a lot of questions that were asked to me in interviews. You know, how is it that you're so sensitive? You know, I say, listen, I was raised by a single mother, and first by my grandmother, then by my single mother. You know, I really didn't. You know, so I have nothing but sensitivity towards it, and I know women quite well.
You know. So you have something in common with Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Right? Both raised by single moms and also the grandmother.
Clinton.
Yeah. Are you a Barack Obama person? Are you a Hillary Clinton person?
You know, I can't vote. I'm Canadian. So if I had to vote for somebody, I probably would have voted for Hillary.
Uh-huh.
And only because I think that you kind of get two for one with her.
Uh-huh.
You're still going to get Bill and his experience.
Yeah.
Like him or not, you know, he was actually a pretty great president.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I think that it'll be awesome, you know.
Yeah,
To have essentially two brains instead of one.
Yeah. Well, all right, man. I guess I'll tidy this up, because I got to get to another. I have to go talk to Errol Morris, and his film.
All right,
you know, it's really interesting. Speaking of the, you know, I love. I'm a big fan of any intimate film that uses 2:35:1 widescreen. You know.
Yeah.
And
I definitely like. We shot anamorphic too, so it's like ultra sharp.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. Anamorphic 2:35.